hope everybody is feeling good this morning. I've gone to a lot of conventions in my time, and I've never felt as nervous as I am today. The other times, the nervousness didn't come for what I was doing. It was what I had done the night before. So, this being our 10 o'clock meeting, we will open it with 30 seconds silence in memory of all the recoveries that have taken place during the last 30 years. Would stand, please. 30 seconds. Repeat the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things that cannot change, courage to change the things that can, and the wisdom to know the difference. At this point, for the benefit of any press or other public media, we would like to explain our anonymity tradition. There may be some who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. If so, we respectfully ask that no AA speaker or member be identified by full name in published or broadcast reports of our meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential to our efforts and to help other alcoholics, and our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personality. Now, at this time, I should qualify myself. I'm Jim Guy from Sydney, Nova Scotia, not quite to the easterly point of the country, because we have the boys from Newfoundland. I want to say hi to you all, and I hope that you folks down there will take some of the nervousness away from me. Carry the load for me, as it were. You've done it for quite a number of years. I won't go into my pattern, because we have three speakers here who have much more experience in it than I have. It's sort of a coincidence I should come to Toronto for my first world conference, because it was here that I did most of my training as an alcoholic. So these meetings are to be run off more or less on schedule, and the format has been laid down for us. I will make no talks on the talks, and we will go into the meeting immediately. Now, the first speaker is Mike, and from what I hear, Mike is one of the veterans in the Detroit area. And now I give you Mike Yee.
Hi. I'm Mike Yee. And I'm an alcoholic. In qualification, I'd like to kick it off a little differently than a lot of people do. I'm 72 years old. I drank for 30 years. I have now been an active and sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 26 years. And I believe I know something about the subject that we're going to discuss this morning. Having had the opportunity of doing a lot of research for some 55 years. I came from a decent family, the same as probably every other person in the audience has. Given the privilege of an early Christian training, I got acquainted with alcohol at an early age and liked it and stayed with it for almost a half a lifetime, until finally alcohol, being the insidious thing that it is, started to take care of me during my last 5 years of drinking. And up until that time, I had done a pretty fair job of living a decent life. I went into the United States Army as a buck private and came out with a commission. When World War I was finished, I took a position with a large parts manufacturing company in Detroit. Started on a spot welder and wound up at the top of the management department of that company. And along about then, alcohol had taken its hold on me, and as was my habit and as is the habit of a lot of other alcoholics, we would go out and tie one on, and two or three days later we'd report for work. And I did this, and one morning I came in, and although I'd worked in this organization for almost 20 years, they had changed management, and my direct supervisor called me into his office and said, the next time you're off sick and don't let us know about it, you're through. Well, had I known then what I have learned in these many years of working with alcoholics, I would have said, well, you better get my pay together now because I'm going to need it. Instead of that, I took my place at my desk and went on, thought that I could lick this thing. I had no idea what was wrong with me. I have learned since that I was sick, that I had a disease, that I was allergic to alcohol, as a diabetic is allergic to sugar. And it wasn't very long until I went out and tied another one on, and our office was the size of this part of the hall. The boss's office was on that side, and mine was on this side, and these people out there worked for me. He called me into his office, and he said, I thought I told you so-and-so. And I said, yes, you did, but that seems like a pretty severe sentence for being off just a few days. He says, that doesn't make any difference. You're finished. Your pay's made up. You can go up to the cashier and get your check, and you're through. I went back to my desk and got to thinking what a terrible thing it was going to be for me to pick up all the plunder that I had accumulated over a period of 18 years, and thought it'd be nice if I could do that at some more appropriate time. I walked back into his office and asked him if it would be all night for all right if I came in that evening and got my things together. And he said, you get your things together now and get out. Well, I'd hate to tell you what I thought of doing to that man for that kind of treatment. Needless to say, I put him on a list I had, and you know what kind of a list I'm talking about. I went on, as all alcoholics do, and went down the street and started myself a little ginny of my own down there, and took old John Barleycorn right along with me, and we used to drink our lunches. I had a lot of telephone calls, not from people that wanted to give me orders, but from people who wanted to know when I was going to pay them what I owed them. About that time, a friend of mine was sent to Akron by his company, one of the largest automobile manufacturers in the city. They had heard about AA, and they thought enough of this movement to send him with their personnel director to Akron to see if something couldn't be done for him. When he left, I said to my friends, it's too bad that this friend of mine had to go away. They say he's an alcoholic. And I certainly, before anything like that happened to me, I'd do something about it. My friend went, and I saw him leave, broken in body and mind and spirit, the most terrible-looking individual you could quite imagine. And in a few short weeks, I saw him return to Detroit after meeting Dr. Bob and Bill and staying with them for a few weeks. And when he came back, he was an entirely different looking and acting individual. And I saw something in him that I shall never forget. It was only a few weeks after that that this incident that I'm telling you about piled up more and more. And I sent for him. And he came and brought me this wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It'd be awful hard for me in the time that's allotted here to cover everything that I'd like to tell you about how he told me how to use this program and how, if I would pay attention to what he told me, I was to have sobriety. The first thing he said was that I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. No job for me to do that. While we're on that subject, that step must be taken before any of us can ever expect to gain sobriety. He said I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I had no idea that I was insane until I reflected on some of the things that I had been doing. Some treatment that I had been given. A wife who for almost 20 years stayed at home, kept the home fires burning, was gainfully employed, only waiting for the time when the guy got home that she thought she married. No one but an insane man would take a position in trust, such as I had, until I got to the top of this multi-million-dollar corporation, only to be thrown out in the middle of the street on account of being a drunk. No one would treat their friends like I treated mine. And certainly no one would take a good healthy body and a good clean mind, such as I had been privileged to be endowed with, and treat it like I had treated my mind and body from the excessive use of alcohol. I took that step. He said I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. I didn't know anything about God. You didn't find him in the gin mills. And so I set about the proposition of finding out about God. My sponsor gave me the Holy Bible and the Upper Room. And along about then, he said to me, you know, if you're going to embrace this program, you've taken your last drink. I said, that seems like an awful long while. And he said, well, it is, but we have an easy way of taking care of that. I said, don't you get well so that you can back and drink just a little? And he said, no. But he said, so that we are successful, we get up in the morning and we have what we call a quiet time. And that's the portion of the day that we set aside to prepare ourselves for those times when we're going to want to drink. He said, we do it by reading this little booklet, The Upper Room and the Holy Bible. He said, you don't need to use the Upper Room. Use anything that you can get a hold of, but do have something in the morning. And he said, then we ask this power that's greater than ourselves to give us strength for just this 24 hours not to take a drink. And when the day is finished, and we've had sobriety for that one day, we get down on our knees and thank Almighty God for the privilege of just one day's sobriety. And he said the days will go into weeks and the weeks into months and the months into years, and we've got men who have had several years of sobriety right on that premise. And I started in back there these many years, and I have worked just one day at a time. And I can tell you today that it does work, because that's all I've done is just stay sober one day at a time. My friend said it, well, of course, the next step, I took that searching and fearless moral inventory. And that's when I had a real good look at yours truly. That's when, search as I might, I couldn't find one solitary thing that I could place on the right side of the ledger. About the only thing, I guess, was that I wasn't a hypocrite. I had stayed away from the church and spiritual side of life. And then my friend said to me, you know, this program is based on absolute honesty. And the first person you have to start to be honest with is yourself. Well, although the sentence of not having, being able to take another drink almost threw me, this one really got me down. This got me down because I can't take anyone else's inventory in the place. But as far as I was concerned, to do the things that I did and to drink the way I wanted to and had to, I had to be dishonest. And the person that I was most dishonest with was this good wife of mine who had been gainfully employed all these 20 years that I was kicking John Barleycorn around, and I knew to a dollar how much she was making, but I never saw fit to tell her how much I was making. And here I'm getting into a deal where I've got to begin to be honest. She could send me to the store with a dollar bill and couldn't expect to get the right change back. We got to that place in life where we had no bank account at all because I just messed up the one we did have too bad. And here I'm into a deal where I have to be honest. It was quite a chore. But I started in, and as we were told in the early days, and we are yet, that easy does it, a little at a time. My sponsor told me you can't anyways come to understanding all of these 12 steps for quite some time, but take them one at a time. And I did that, and today I've got that joint bank account back again, and she sends me to the store and gets the right change out of a dollar bill when I get home. I found out something else about honesty. I used to be the biggest liar in 14 counties. They used to call me Baron Munchausen. I'd lie when the truth had served better. And I found out something. In the old days, my wife used to say to me, honey, I want to ask you something. And when she'd say that, I began to get quick on the trigger, wondering what she was going to ask me so I could figure up the lie to tell her about what she was going to ask me. And now I can sit in my easy chair in the living room, have the television on, and read the newspaper and listen to her all at the same time. And when she says, honey, I want to ask you something, I don't even flutter the leaf of that newspaper. Why? Because I'm going to tell her the truth. And you'll be surprised at the amount of time I've saved by just telling the truth, because I just have to say it once. Going back to this quiet time, I want to stress it for just one moment. I started in back there these many years ago to have the quiet time in the morning. And a while after that, when my wife saw the old man coming home sober every night, and it was a long while before there was any paydays, but she knew I was sober and knew I was home, and I wasn't lousing up any more of these holidays that I used to louse up. And she asked me I didn't think it would be a good thing for both of us to have this quiet time in the morning. And we started in back there many, many years ago, and we wouldn't think of setting the breakfast table in the morning now without the upper room and the Holy Bible and that little 24-hour-a-day booklet, which is a gem, which I can recommend very highly. After we'd been in AA a while, and I had had sobriety, I found on the back page of a Unity magazine a prayer that I've passed on to my audiences over the years, a prayer that I'm sure that if you can adopt and say every morning, you will be buying the greatest amount of insurance, not only of not taking a drink for the next 24 hours, but having any other trouble that you can't cope with. I'd like to say that prayer for you this morning. It goes like this. One morning she says it, and the next morning I say it. Lord, in the quiet of this morning hour, we come to Thee for peace, for wisdom, for power, to view the world today through love-filled eyes. Be patient, understanding, gentle, wise. To see beyond what seems to be, and know thy children as thou knowest them. And so not but the good in any one behold. Make deaf our ears to slander that is told. Silence our tongues to aught that is unkind. Let only thoughts that bless dwell in our minds. Let us so kindly be, so full of cheer that all we meet may feel thy presence near. O clothe us in thy beauty, this we pray. Let us reveal thee, Lord, through all the day. Going on through the steps a little farther, we find that we were supposed to admit to God in the presence of another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Humbly ask God to correct our shortcomings and be willing to have him remove our defects of character. I took those steps, but I found the same as a lot of other people found, that maybe we weren't too willing to have God remove those defects of character. Maybe we would like to hang on to some of our shortcomings. You know, I don't know whether I told you or not, but when I got into this deal, I was bankrupt in every department of my life, mentally, physically, morally, and financially. You don't need to use your imagination in any of those categories. I was finished. I was completely washed up. I sat in a gin mill, just a few blocks from a nice home in which I had a small equity and a wife who I was to find out I had a lot smaller equity in, and meditated with myself whether or not I'd go to Skid Row or not. And the only reason I didn't get to Skid Row was that I thought I had a crutch I could lean on, and I went home and asked this good wife of mine if she'd give me a lift out of the jam I was in, and the answer was no. And that was the smartest thing she'd ever said to me in almost the 20 years that we'd lived together. Because that's when I knew the chips were all down, and that unless I liked it or not, I had to go up. And that was the only way. And I don't know about you fellows out there, but it was never my privilege to sober up any other way but the hard way. And some of you that had to do it that way all the time know what I'm talking about. And so I took this step that we're talking about, and I thought that I was willing to have God remove my defects of character. And I got into AA in the fall of the year, and I said to myself as I looked around and saw these other fellows come in from penitentiaries and insane asylums and skid rows, and they had no home or they had no friends or they had no relatives. And I said, well, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. You see, I had gotten my health back by then. I was back home where I was eating 3 square meals a day. And I said to myself, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe I can go out and do some controlled drinking. And I decided that I would stay with AA until spring, and then I'd go up north and pitch myself a drunk and do some controlled drinking. I was just going to start in on beer for a while. By the grace of God, I didn't have to try that noble experiment. And I bring it up only to tell you that the only difference between myself and the fellow that's had some trouble with AA is that he, too, toyed with the idea that he could do some controlled drinking, and he failed miserably, because I know of no one who is an alcoholic who has ever succeeded in going back and drinking again. I said from the platform many times I wouldn't take a drink again for $1 million. Some people say, I've heard it said, I haven't had a drink for so long, I don't know about tomorrow, but I haven't had one. Well, I know about tomorrow. I'm not going to compromise for one moment with the idea of ever taking a drink again, because the minute I compromise, I'm leaving old John Giddy's foot in the door. And it isn't the last one that we have to look out for, is that first one. I see my time's running out. I'd like to just touch on step number 11 and then finish. That's the step that said we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. My sponsor told me that that was the powerhouse of this whole program, and I have lived to see that that is what is true. I have used that step in all departments of my life. I have never gone to the Lord with requests for my own personal use. Rather, my prayer has been, give me tolerance and patience and love and wisdom and understanding. Take me and use me as thy instrument to help these other alcoholics, and let me pass this wonderful word on to those who are yet to come. And it's worked. And I guess that's about all, except to say that it's been a great privilege for me to be in AA, because I have been able to use a lot of AA people to help me stay sober. In this very room, there is 100 years of sobriety, if I were to ask them to stand on their feet, of people who have been privileged to have working for me in the years that I was in AA. Those are the people that helped me stay sober. At one time or another, it was my privilege to have working for me a man from every correctional institution in the state of Michigan. We can start up at Marquette, that's our big prison, and go down through the state until we wind up at the federal penitentiary at Milan. And there I had a fellow that used to work for the post office department, and he got his money mixed up with Uncle Sam's, and he sent him away for a year. And when he got out, he went to work for me. And 10 years ago, when I sold my interest in the plant, he was the night superintendent. I guess that's about all. Other to say that as we go our several ways in these weeks and months to come, let us ever be mindful of the duty we owe to God and man, and let us do be careful how we live. We may be the only Bible that some people ever read. Thank you.
As I said, there'll be no comments from me on any of the talks, and thank you, Mike. Now, as at all meetings of AA, we try to add beauty to the meetings, and in this case, we do have Kathy A. from Las Vegas.
I wish I had met you 25 years ago. My name is Kathy. I was born to be, I am now, and I shall always be an alcoholic.
Hi.
This is a wonderful, wonderful occasion. I think it's been the longest countdown in history. No astronaut could survive it, that's for darn sure. When I got that invitation from New York, I sat and bawled like a baby. I thought I had never seen anything so wonderful. So, of course, typically alcoholic, I wrote Hazel immediately and said, I've never been so thrilled and happy in my life. And I cheerfully would have gone and rifled the mailbox afterwards to try to get the letter back. Because no speaker am I. I'm one of these middle timers now where they call on me only when the speaker doesn't show up. And this is very infrequently, believe me. I'd like to give you my vital statistics. You hear about these beauty queens, you know, they give them the measurements. I have 57, 4, and 15 and a half. Physical years, 57, 4 years of slips, and 15 years of happy sobriety in AA. 15 and a half almost. It's easy to tell the age now. You know, I've long since passed the stage and say, are you really? Now they say, gee, you look older than that. So when it's all right. I was very happy to find, too, when I came to AA that I read somewhere that the Norwegians, or rather the Scandinavian race and the Irish, had the highest percentage of alcoholism in the world. And my father was a Norwegian, my mother was Irish. I thought it was very careless of them to have been born in this country, however. I wanted to be a first-generation American, and I always claimed I lied all through my drinking days. My father was born in Norway. I'd pick a different town every time, of course, if I could pronounce it. And my mother was always from County Cork. I thought that was quite delightful. Also, I have one other qualification, I think, for being here. I am what they call, in Las Vegas, we code on our credit cards, an LOL, which means, in our terminology, loaded old lady. And perhaps I suppose that Las Vegas does have some interest for most people. It has a sinister connotation. It has a glamorous one, too. It is a time bomb for the drinking alcoholic, that's for sure. No liquor store is closed. You can get whiskey. You can get anything 24 hours. And when you do run out of money, you can get free drinks even at the nickel slot machines. This would have been marvelous in my days. Unfortunately, I was sober when I moved to Las Vegas. And even when you do run out of money and out of drinking money and gambling money, you can always go to a pit boss, and they have kind, kind hearts, and they will always put out the price of a drink if you can say that you have lost all of your money in their particular casino. And the alcoholic, of course, will know that he can make every casino on the strip and downtown, and there are three of them on every all around the clock, and you can go on drinking for quite a long time. Of course, I know my fate would have been to have been ushered to the door by a security guard where the county or a city policeman would have been waiting to take me to the pokey. However, I didn't make the pokey in any place, really. I said I was born to be an alcoholic, and perhaps I do have, if there is such a thing as being preconditioned. My own mother was a drunkard. My father divorced her when I was 5, and I never saw her in my life until I was about 32 years old, and I saw myself then completely in her. My father died in the county insane asylum when I was 17, and my young husband, whom I had married at 18, died on the operating table when I was 23. Now, this gave me everything in the background to the tragic, of course. I could drink and cry in my beer over this terrific fate that life had given me. But I had already found the battle at 23, and at 24, I knew what the horrible hangovers were, the kind that you have to lie flat on the floor until the waves of nausea go away and you break out into a cold sweat, and then you can get up and vomit, but not before. This I knew. This seemed a little bit odd to me then, but I thought, well, other people have them, but they don't talk about it, perhaps, so it's not quite the ladylike thing to do. Probably my first real drunk was at, I don't even say 14 anymore. Other people have topped me so many times on the age department, but I must have been around there. It was on a double date, and we drank water glasses full of gin. My best friend, who was on the date as well, violently sick and began to upchuck over the side of the car. And I think I thought this was the ladylike thing to do, and I had better do it, too. And, of course, I was very sick. But I do remember, even now, and that was a long, long time ago, that I had another little drink just to settle my stomach afterwards. And I spent about 2.5 decades after that settling my stomach. It took an awful lot of it. When my father died, I suppose that was the first pure emotion that I had known, that I had experienced. I adored him. He was a wonderful father. And it wasn't until many years later in AA that I was truly grateful that he hadn't lived to see his darling daughter as a hopeless alcoholic. When my young husband died, I bargained with God to save him. And I offered up then my most precious gift, drinking. I said I'd never drink again if he were saved. He was not. Consequently, I drank again. And I played the grieving widow for well over a year, and I played it to perfection. Some of it was real, but I think about 90% pure theater. I also was bemoaning through those years, of course, these lost careers of mine, these great things that I could have been. Not one, two, but three persons could I have been, outstanding in the world, of course. First, I thought I could have been the greatest actress. Just not too long ago, I re-examined my life about that time, and I decided that the only thing that ever qualified me for being an actress was reciting Barbara Fritchie when I was 11 and 12 years old. And when I said, shoot if you must this old gray head, but spare your country's flag, she said, this was wonderful. But there was another boy in the class who could recite Paul Revere, and that was three times as long, so I was always second anyhow. I always thought, too, that I could be a great journalist, but the only thing that I ever did was work for my high school newspaper, and I had my byline once, but from then on, I was another Walter Winchell in my mind. A third thing that I was certain I could have been was a great dancer. I had dancing lessons, and we did the gavotte and the minuet and things like that. But when it came time later for the Charleston contests, I was always either passed out in the ladies' lounge or I was being walked around the block to sober me up. And that was in the 20s. So none of my careers ever panned out at all. After a number of years after my husband died, it never occurred to me that the drinking had anything to do with the absence of another marriage. I was much engaged, but never married. There was always that time when I had been building the illusion of what I was, and then I would get good and drunk. And then there would be the scenes and the shouting and the disheveled hair and the glassy eyes and the smeared lipstick, and I didn't have any more fiancé after that. And this was not too good. And finally, in 1941, I decided, well, I think I'll maybe quit drinking and just see what happens. And so for 24 endless days, I did. At the end of that time, I was hospitalized with a muscle spasm in my back. And I figured, well, this is what happens when you stop drinking. Then I ran into an old schoolmate whom I hadn't known very well in high school, who was fresh out of wives at the moment, and we got married. And for the first time, I knew what it was to really drink uninhibitedly. He was an alcoholic, perhaps. He said he was the neatest drunk on Rush Street in Chicago, and that is quite an achievement. But then we drank around the clock. Very shortly, I was fired from the good job that I had had. I had become a secretary through the years, and how, I'm sure, I don't know. I never finished shorthand, and my typing wasn't very good. But I managed. I was a typical phony and fraud, and I managed to carry a good job. But we drank around the clock until we were evicted from the apartment. The car was repossessed, and it was time to move. It was time to do something about it. About that time, war was declared, and my dear little flat-footed husband was deferred. I tried to enlist in the WACS, and they didn't accept me, and possibly it was due to the fact that I'd had three Manhattans before I went down for the interview, and I was telling them just exactly how this should be done, you know. At any rate, we moved to California, where anyone could get a job, of course, during the war years. And then began the beatings and the awful, and I did my share of giving him his lumps, too. That's for darn sure. I always managed that very well. But then I left California, I went back to Chicago, and I found that when I left him, the drinking was still going on. And then I would get back to California again. How I managed to go back and forth across the country, I'll never know. Transportation was quite a problem in those days. But I managed it somehow, and I never knew what the country looked like between Chicago and California. But finally, at some point when I was away, he had contacted AA. And I arrived once, and he had been sober all of 3 weeks. And this was fantastic. I didn't like him at all. He was very severe and very changed, and he wouldn't let me have a drink. And this, of course, was not the thing at all. I did consent to listen to two of his AA friends who came over calling, and they brought the big book and a bottle. And I thought these were the greatest guys in the world. And I leafed through the book, you know, just like this, and very disdainfully tossed it on the floor after they left. I said, of course, I could have written a much better one drunk than they had sober. No question about that. This happened several times. I came back finally to Chicago, and I read a book, and I never have found anyone who can tell me the title or the author. It was about an alcoholic. And somewhere in that book, it suddenly dawned on me that possibly I might be one of those people. Now, this gave me a lot of prestige in my thinking. I was a woman of distinction. I was very different, and I thought I would try this on for size for a little bit. However, it was only my intention to find out a little bit about it, and then I thought I could sober him up enough so he wouldn't beat me quite so much, and we could go back to our halcyon existence again. Well, needless to say, that did not work. And I then became the original revolving door AA in Chicago. I was in again, out again. I'd have 3 months of sobriety and then 6 weeks of slips. I used to count up the days that I had been sober and try to figure maybe I had made a year along in there somewhere, but I really hadn't. And I think I always afraid that if I ever once made the year, I'd be totally committed. I would have had to admit and surrender to the fact that I was an alcoholic. And this I was not about to do. It was lip service with me only, and I like the distinction. I like to talk about it. I like to tell people that I was an alcoholic, and I particularly like to tell them where I worked, because that explained an awful lot of things. When these sudden absences, they'd plan a cocktail party, and I'd get drunk before the cocktail party because I'd be afraid of going to the cocktail party. I didn't know what I was going to do then. Finally, I had my last splashdown about 15 and a half years ago. It was February of 1950. I was working at a resort in Phoenix, Arizona, and I used as an excuse an aunt of mine who was dying in Oshkosh. Actually, I had started to drink a week before, and this time I declared that I was no longer, nor had I ever been, an alcoholic, that I had just been my usual melodramatic self, and I had wanted to claim this distinction. And so now I was going to be completely honest and say I wasn't an alcoholic and never had been one. So I went to Chicago first, and for a monumental drunk. I thought I had sobered up enough, just a little bit enough, so that I could get up to Oshkosh to see this aunt of mine who was dying. And I loved her more than the mother I had never known. She had been really wonderful to me. I arrived that night. Apparently, I went to the hospital, my cousin told me later. I don't remember going at all. The next day, I needed a drink so desperately. I shook and shivered for at least 2 or 3 hours, trying to avoid the time when I would have to go to the hospital to see her. Eventually, I had to go without a drink, and I had been drinking for well over 2 weeks at that time, and you know how I was feeling. We finally got there, and I did see her, and I think I stayed 10 minutes, and all I could think about was getting on that club car again on the train back to Chicago so I could have not one but 3 or 4 fast ones to anchor my stomach again and my nerves. I never saw that aunt again. She died. But this apparently was the one unforgivable crime against myself and all that I really wanted to believe in. This was the one thing that I could not condone. There had been many, many other unspeakable, inadmissible sins that I had committed. But this was the thing that I could not forgive myself for. And for me, it was the bottom of the bottle. I went back to Phoenix. They put me in a rest home, and I shook it out for another 5 days. And that, on that occasion, when I left Chicago, was the occasion of my last drink. And from then on, of course, there has been nothing but good. Within 7 months, I met and married a non-alcoholic. And he had been married for 12 years to a practicing alcoholic who had died the previous year. And I, who had been childless, was now given a son. One moment. And no one except a barren woman knows what this means. The years have been real, real good. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do this at all. I hope you will forgive me. But the thing that I have been trying to do in this past month, I guess, is taking that fourth step for the first time. Perhaps I've taken it perhaps 100 times. But now I've been trying to find out what has happened to me since I've been in AA. This is the important thing from a middle-timer like myself. What are we like now? In my own group, of course, I can't tell them because they know and they don't care a great deal anyhow. But I do know that some of the virtues that I thought I had acquired are not particularly good. I'm obsessively punctual now, and AAs don't like this very much. Not at all. I suppose that I have learned a little patience, not a very great deal. I haven't learned very much with myself at all. I think I've tried to learn to be kind, which to me means looking at the other side of the coin. And I don't have pride myself on these honeyed harpoons anymore that I was so excellent with, my sarcasm and my biting wit, of course. And I've also learned in AA that I am neither witty nor wise. I also discovered that I have, I think, just 2 talents. I tried to find out, was there anything that I did well that I could be proud of? And I spell very well. I'm a good speller. This is fine. And I can swim pretty well, too. But you can't build a lifetime around spelling and swimming. so I just don't have too much of that. I do know that in those 4 years that I was slipping and sliding around AA, naturally I did no 12-step work. I mean, how could I? I couldn't have stayed sober long enough to get a baby to 3 consecutive meetings, I don't think. I was in Miami where I found my first happy sobriety in the North Bay group. I was very active in 12-step work, and that was terrifically good for me. It was wonderful for me. I have some babies in Las Vegas. My newest baby, my last baby, is here today, I hope. She's young and lovely and sober 6 years. And for her, I shall be eternally grateful. I'm eternally grateful to the people in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Florida and Chicago and Las Vegas who have tolerated me through the years. And the ones in Las Vegas, particularly in the state of Nevada, who elected me as delegate to the New York Conference for 1963 and 64. This was the greatest privilege and honor and experience that I have ever had. It's a lot of hard work, but it's something that is so magnificent, really, that I say, women of AA, arise and let more of us go to New York. I should like to say that I think I read somewhere, there's a poet somewhere, and I don't quote poets at all, who has said, "Go old along with me, the best is yet to be." May the good Lord continue to hold us in the hollow of his hand.
Thank you, Kathy. Now we go to Carolina for Bill.
Good morning. Speaking of good morning, a couple of weeks ago at one of our local groups at home, a young man used this, and I'm going to give him credit for it once, and from then on it's mine. Jerry D. said, "Isn't it wonderful to awaken and say, good morning, God, rather than good God, it's morning." Yes, I'm Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. And there's not the least scintilla of evidence to the contrary. I've tried every known method to prove the otherwise, and they all failed. And with the help of God and my wonderful wife and this program, I hope to continue a life of sobriety. I am relatively a neophyte, just barely 5 years old. In the interest of time, I will not do much qualifying through my drinking escapades. But I will assure you that your cruelest imagination would be kind in comparison to the true facts. I've been there with the DTs and hallucinations and convulsions and all the rest that goes with it. I have to go back into my background just a little bit to give you my story. I was born on Groundhog Day back in the mountains of North Carolina. And the mountaineers, you know, are pretty well known for their dealings with liquor. They make it, they drink it, and they sell it. The smart ones sell it. By the way, you may have never heard of the mountaineers' ideal midwinter dream. And this would go: the harvest is in, the crops laid by, the old woman's pregnant, and the cow's gone dry. Nothing to do but drink. Thank you. I am the youngest of 4 children, and of the 6 members of my family, 5 of them were either addicted to alcohol or narcotics or both. I have a brother that's not addicted to anything, but I do notice that he's allergic to work. I have a sister, and God willing, as of tomorrow, she will be 18 years in here without a drink. I had another sister It was found dead as a result of Saconol and alcohol. My mother was addicted to narcotics and was never arrested. My father was an alcoholic, but by the grace of God, and in his case, a lot of willpower. There was no AA then. He was sober the last 10 years of his life. And he became a very lovable, wonderful man, and he became quite prominent. He was a Superior Court judge the last 7 years of his life. So there's a little picture. This one here, the baby, was given the constitution of a rhinoceros, the stubborn will of a mule, and a photographic memory. And if that won't make an alcoholic out of you, I don't know what will. I do not impute my alcoholism to my family background. I was conscious of right and wrong from the time I was conscious of being a human being. And it seemed to me that the wrong way was the easiest, the best way, and the most popular. I did have, as a result of my family background, feelings of rejection. I spent most of my time in boarding school from the time I was age 5 on up. And it seems like when you keep getting sent away from home, that apparently somebody don't want you. And if you feel like your family doesn't want you, how do you expect total strangers to accept you? So it was natural, and I look back in retrospect, that I developed resentments and feeling of hostility. And this was suppressed, of course, in the subconscious. But I was most uncomfortable. But in my middle teens, I found this wonderful beverage, alcohol. If you can call white Georgia corn liquor a beverage. But this stuff, it made me drunk. It made me sick. But in between that first drink and throwing up, it made me something else. It made me 9 feet tall and put steel wool on my chest. And I could sing and dance. In the later years, I discovered it'd make you see double and feel single, too. I developed a terrific tolerance for alcohol. I had a great capacity for it. And I loved that stuff. I could sop it with a biscuit. It was wonderful. My father, on seeing me drunk on several occasions, admonished me that if I was going to drink, I better learn to hold it. This was the code of the hills. And I was determined to drink it, so I was determined to hold it. And I learned to scotch myself against staggering or slurring my words or misbehaving at times when it could be dangerous. By the time that I came into AA, I had established such a good practice of being drunk and appearing sober. The people said, well, what are you doing here? We didn't know you had a problem. We've never seen you drunk. Well, I was sort of like the subject in a joke. This bride of 6 months ran home to her mother in tears, and her mother says, what's wrong? She said, I've married an alcoholic. She said, when did you discover that? I said, last night he came home sober. So, these folks had never seen me sober, so how would they know the difference? It was that simple. In spite of alcohol, I had a good academic career, and later on, a fairly good athletic career. There were even spots of brilliance in it. And had I really taken seriously what they meant about training, I might have made a name for myself. While I was in college, one Saturday morning, with the worst hangover I'd ever had in my life up to that time, I broke the 100-yard dash record of the college there, and if there had been a jug of liquor at the end of the track, you'd have heard about a new world record, too. In college, I acquired a nickname, like most athletes do, but it didn't have anything to do with athletics. I was known as Whiskey Bill. Now, that's something to write home about, too, you know. No, it wasn't because I was drunk all the time, but I was either going after liquor or coming back with it, or on a party, or starting one, or having something to do with frivolity. I had no trouble with academic work, with this memory of mine, and good lateral reading. And at the end of 2.5 years, I left college and went to Raleigh to go to work. I needed money to carry on my way of life. I also went to law school at night for 4 years and finished it. It was no great trouble. I married one of the finest and loveliest women in this world, and if I had a few hours, I could really tell you about her. She's something. I went in service in 1942, And this sounds very creditable, but it's not. I went in as a private and came out as a major. So what? I'd been in military since I was 13. I memorized the IDR, and anybody can be impressed with that. And it was nothing, really. Stationed up here near Detroit for a while and around, never got out of the country. I was never called to duty, but that I was able to make it. And that means just what it says. They never call me when I couldn't make it. That's just the only reason for it. After service and a short period of employment with the federal government, a bonanza or a windfall fell on this blooming alcoholic. It was better than a legacy from a very wealthy relative, because I acquired a position which gave me all of the free beer, wine, and whiskey that I wanted, with a big, fat salary, one of which I had never dreamed of having, and an unquestioned expense account, and a position of prestige. I was the executive secretary of the North Carolina Association of Beer Distributors. Now, boy, if that ain't a good one. And for the next 10 years, this was really a merry-go-round. I, of course, got involved in politics and getting around the state in the elections and whatnot. But the best part, I became a lobbyist in the legislature. Now, this, to me, was being a big shot. And I think all alcoholics really want to be a big shot. And I was there to influence legislation and so forth and so on. And I took great credit for my accomplishments in this field, only to discover when I woke up and became sober that many of these people in that House and Senate were doing favors for me through out of respect and memory of my father. I looked just like him and talked just like him. And then I weighed about 45 more pounds than I do now, and we went quite a bit alike. I just didn't have as much up here. But I don't say some credit wasn't due me. Anybody can pick up a little something by watching other people. We certainly do this in AA. But my friend Mike here, with these many years of sobriety, and many things about him, can outshadow me and everything. But I'll challenge him to a lion contest any time he wants. You've got to be a successful liar, have 9 lies ready to back up that first one, and I could do it. My wife could ask me about something that I told her 6 months before, and I'd repeat it verbatim and throw in a couple of extras for color. I was sort of like Huckleberry Tart. An old boy lived down on the border of North and South Carolina. He was so famous as a liar, people used to just actually go up and beg him to tell them a lie. A fella stopped him one day and said, "Huckleberry, tell me a lie." He said, "I ain't got time. The Yadkin River's on fire, and I got to go put it out." Yes, I would lie even when there wasn't time to. But I don't have to lie anymore. And I can walk across the house to get something and forget what in the heck it was when I got there. And it's a good feeling. I don't think a memory's worth anything except for lying, because if you tell the truth every time, it comes out the same way. And it's not near as hard to work. To the serious part of this program, my coming into AA, twice, of course, I had left home, gone to Orlando, Florida, to get a divorce. My wife had become unmanageable. I had gone to stay with my brother and his wife, and when I pulled up in their yard, I had driven down there. It's 630 miles from Raleigh, or 6.5 pints of Glenmore. Just figured either way. I was a hospital case before I ever left Raleigh. Oh, I'd been in the hospital many, many times, you know, for viruses and hypertension and things of that sort. And my sister-in-law looked at me and said, "Doesn't look like anything's wrong with you." See, she'd been talking to those lying people back in Raleigh. I said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with me." And I didn't look it. But I was about to fly to pieces. I was sort of like the fellow that said he got so upset and frustrated one night that he ran out of the house and jumped on a horse and rode off in 4 different directions. And this is about the way I was. My sister-in-law had asked me, after I'd been there several weeks, would I take her to church. My brother doesn't go to church. I don't know why, and that's his business. And she had noticed that I had a prayer book with me. I told her yes, we'd go. We'd go the next Sunday. Well, something developed that she couldn't go that Sunday. And I picked the next one. It was the 5th of July. And it was hot. and the town was crowded, a lot of people. And I was reasonably sober. I hadn't had but three drinks, and I left the house. And when we got into the traffic area there, there was a policeman at each corner directing traffic. This is remarkable to me. Why I should stop at the third policeman rather than the first one or the fifth one, I didn't know then, but I think I know why now. But this policeman at the third block, I asked him where the nearest church was, and I didn't specify a denomination. He said, turn to the right at the end of the block. And lo and behold, I pulled up in front of St. Michael's Episcopal Church, the identical name and denomination of the church that rests practically in my backyard in Raleigh. And this pleased me. But then I went on into this church to get the greatest shock that I had ever had in my life. And there were about 30 people behind me going down that aisle. If they hadn't been, I'd gotten the heck out. For the usher handed me a church bulletin with a picture of a drunk passed out of the table with his glass, ashtray, and bottle. And I said, my God, I've walked into a hellfire and brimstone prohibition outfit. But I sat there on my hands, sweating and trembling, waiting for this great lecture to come, and it never came. I put this bulletin in my pocket, and this is something I rarely ever did unless I needed evidence that I'd been to church. Well, I had a witness this morning. And I put this in my pocket, and it was several weeks later when I was in the hospital in Raleigh, when I looked on the back of it and found that it had an article about alcoholism and the miraculous work being done by a fellowship known as Alcoholics Anonymous. Many say this was coincidence. I say not. This was a form jacket which was mimeographed on the inside for the local church, made up in the Diocese of Chicago, sent to Orlando, Florida, where Bill J. from Raleigh all come together. This is wearing out, and I wrote the Diocese of Chicago for another copy or two. They wrote me back and said, we never had but one request for this, and we'll send you this one copy. I've had many, many more made, and I will keep them forever. Yes, when I came back to Raleigh, my wife and I had become reconciled. Actually, she came down there and got me, see. She was afraid she was going to lose this prize package. I forgave her for all of her meanness and sorriness. And I came back to Raleigh to do something about my drinking, which, of course, was to drink more. And about the only way I could accomplish this was to start drinking between drinks, as someone had said. I finally threw in the towel and went to the hospital. I did this because it was another escape. I supposed to have been on jury duty that morning, and there ain't no way to sit in a jury box and take a drink every 20 minutes. There's just no way to do it. So, like any alcoholic, I threw in the towel and went to the hospital. I needed to get my wife off my back. I needed to get to feeling better. My liver was sticking out so far I had to back up to knock on a door. I was drinking for the last 2 or 3 years of my drinking life, a half a gallon of liquor a day. And this was not fun whiskey, this was living whiskey. Look at that on a 16-hour day. That ain't but 4 ounces an hour. And when I think about it, I was shortening myself a little bit. I know people taper off that way. In this hospital, it was hell. I had quit twice in my life, twice for 6 months. Once to get my stomach in shape so I could drink some more, and the other time to get my wife off my back and prove to her I wasn't an alcoholic. And I shook for 30 days each time. And while I was there, I read this article. I read some more AA literature. AAs came to see me. And I went into AA while still on pass from the hospital. And I went in as sincerely as I possibly knew how to. I went in to the letter. And it was 7 months later when I woke up and learned that I had to go into it in the spirit. And I learned that I didn't even know how to be honest. I don't mean cash register honesty. I mean, I never stole anything unless it was liquor or money to get it. That don't count against an alcoholic. But I couldn't tell the truth. I was still a total fraud. And a fraud is a false representation of a material fact, and that's what I was. I was out talking when I ought to have been listening. And when I was talking, I wasn't talking AA. I was entertaining. I even had props. I was saying what I thought the people would like to hear so I would be popular. The same old phony that it always had been. But I was feeling pretty good, And I looked for some justifiable argument with my dear wife. You always have to pick on her. And I jumped back in the jug again. I thought that I'd be able to drink for another 3 years. The last time I quit for 6 months, I drank for 21 months. So I thought I had 3 years ahead of me. But 3 weeks later of drinking, it was 5 weeks total, but 3 weeks of drinking, I ended up at our hospital at Butner, the Alcoholic Rehabilitation Center. A gibbering idiot climbing the walls and having fits in terrible mental and physical condition and emotional. Butner is a rehabilitation center. You're not confined. You can leave. They give you nothing to help you off. They do now. In those days, they didn't. It was cold turkey, and it's tough, Mike. I climbed those walls. I could dig plaster and wallpaper out from under my fingernails. And for 8 days and 8 nights over there, it's the worst that I could imagine. And that eighth night, I thought surely to this world that I was dying. Now, I've prayed in my life. About to go off of the mountain road in a snowstorm up the Kulasagi Gorge 300 feet down, I'd naturally say, God help me. And the car would straighten up, and I'd reach under the seat and take a drink. Thank you. Or I've been coming back from Chicago to Raleigh after a convention. It's supposed to have been 3 days, and I was 3 weeks getting back. Pray to God on the plane, let me get back to Raleigh before that check I wrote clears. That's the sort of praying that I had done. But this night, I knew that each breath that I took was my last one, that I was dying. And in plain, simple, sobbing, childlike prayer, I said, God, please help me. And immediately, I quit sweating and shaking, and I became calm. I was scared. I didn't know what had happened. And for a long while, I couldn't explain what I felt then, that presence that was there. But now I know what it was. It was a definite certainty that God loved me. And I went to sleep. And I haven't had a sleepless night since, not from any fear or anxiety or worry. And yet, here's human frailty. The next morning I got up, the first thing I did was write my wife and tell her that something had happened. I didn't fully understand it. I went down to the lobby and said to the patient, says, what in the world has happened to you? And I was ashamed to tell him. I was afraid they'd laugh. Well, I'm no longer ashamed to tell it. I had had a conscious contact with God. And since then, I've had many reassurances. And since then, I've had other fleeting contacts and an unmerited one. And also, I never had any more from that day on any desire or compulsion for alcohol. And I came back to this beautiful and wonderful program of AA. I wanted to know more about this God. My life prior to AA, God had been a God of fear. And in AA, these people showed me a God of love. AA set me on a spiritual exploration which has been the greatest experience in my life. I have learned to read that Bible, the big book, Frank Laubach, Star Daly, Agnes Sanford, and Louise Eggleston, and now I'm very much devoted to Paul Tournier, a great Christian psychiatrist. This is truly one of the most beautiful lives in this world that you can imagine, the AA spiritual life. AA, to me, is a spiritual entity. It's hard to describe, even to the alcoholic himself, the sober alcoholic. Dr. Sam Shoemaker, I believe in his last book, made mention that if the church could catch fire with the Holy Spirit, as he had seen in AA, that we would have a religious renaissance, if not a revolution. And we see this great fire of the Holy Spirit in AA. And to me, the big and the important thing is that this fire wears work clothes with sleeves rolled up and has a smile on his face. And I think maybe that Frank Laubach could also help describe this program for us, too. In his little legend about the difference between heaven and hell under an identical set of circumstances, he said in hell they have a long rectangular banquet table with benches on it and small neck bowls, and the people sit down to eat. But their wrists and their elbows are stiff, and they can't bend them to get in their bowls and feed themselves, so they flail their arms about and fight and fuss. And in heaven, they have the identical situation with the same benches and bowls and stiff elbows and wrists. But these people reach across the table and feed one another.
That's AA. We feed each other.
And that beautiful little anonymous poem that I first saw about 5.5 years ago in Reader's Digest. I sought my soul eluded me, and I sought my God I could not see, and I sought my brother, and I found all three. Yes, we seek our brother, and we feed each other. In this period of sobriety, this very short period, I need something to keep me not sober only at night. I drank around the clock, at least a half a pint before I could shave. And I need something to hang on all through the day. I go to AA about 5 nights a week. And in reading the Bible and these books and listening to these people and talking and counseling with the old-timers, I put together something I call Wearing the World as a Loose Garment, something I dug out of the little 24-hour book. This is not a philosophy, and I keep it in the first person because I'm too much of a neophyte to be given advice. But this little thing to me, I stole part of it out of the grapevine and from here and there. There may be one or two little original thoughts in there, if there is such a thing. But I quite often ask God to let me go calmly and placidly amid the noise and haste of this sick world in which I live. For this is a sick world with its false sense of values and its phony yardstick of success. But let me wear it as a loose garment and not as a burden. Let me take pride in my career, however humble that it may be, for it is a treasure in the changing values of time. Let me not pretend affection, but neither let me be cynical about love, for it is the greatest thing in this world and is as perennial as the grass. It may look dead, but it will always return. And let me not compare myself with others, for there shall always be greater or lesser persons than myself. And I like to say that this is so vividly pointed out in the Beatitudes, the blessed or the meek, and the peacemakers and so forth. I shall have my reward by my own God-given talents, and they shall be gracious. I need not copy anyone. And let me remember that I am a child of this universe, and that God is my Father. I have every right to be here as much as the stars and the trees. And let me also remember, God being my Father, that in my prayers and meditations, let me become acquainted with the Holy Spirit that lives and dwells within me. For here lies all of the knowledge and the strength and the power that I need for any occasion. And all I need to do is draw upon it with faith. But let me not expect the results to come out on my pattern or my timetable, but that of God. And so, with all of its heartaches and drudgery and disappointments, if I wear it as a loose garment, this is still a pretty wonderful world in which to live. Now, I know that a miracle has happened in my life, and this places upon me additional responsibility, which AA also places upon me. And there are things that I must do if I am to keep this miracle alive. I am reminded that Jesus, in his healing of all of the people, he generally suggested they do something first, like the lame man at Bethesda pool. Take up thy bed and walk. Right on down to Lazarus, who was dead, he said, Lazarus, come forth. So I must do things. So to bear this responsibility, I must keep my heart grateful to Almighty God and to live with him at the center of my being. And to be responsible, I must continue to carry this message. And I must, with all my effort, exercise humility and love. And if I can do these things, then I need never fear even being confronted by the Ten Commandments. May God, as you understand him, bless you, and may he guide you and help you in carrying out your responsibilities. Thank you.